You probably missed this, but a couple of days ago, Sandra Fish, a political reporter with the Colorado Sun, was granted a press credential to cover the Colorado State GOP Assembly. And then she was ordered to leave after being told that party chairman Dave Williams found her current reporting to be very unfair. Fish has been covering politics for more than 40 years, but there she was, escorted out of the Colorado State Fairgrounds in Pueblo by a law enforcement official. And to Williams and the Colorado GOP, I ask, do you not believe in democracy? Do you not believe in freedom of the press? Is this how you and yours view America? As a place to suppress voices? As a place where freedom of expression needs to be stomped? Is this who you are? And if so, what are you so afraid of? My name is Jeff Perlman. I'm the New York Times bestselling author of 10 books and the host of Two Writers, Sling and Yang, the podcast where one writer, me, talks writing with another writer every single week. And today's guest is Richard Hoffer, the former Sports Illustrated senior writer and Los Angeles Times sports writer, who, for my dough, is one of the best to ever hold a pen. This is episode number 358. Let's sling some yang.
Dad, your podcast sucks and you smell like Jack Sigma's armpit.
Okay, Richard Hoffer. First of all, I'm being sincere when I say this. This is a thrill for me because, number one, you're one of my favorite writers of all time, and I say that sincerely. And number two, I feel like most of the former SI people I worked with, I have some idea of sort of where they went, or they're active on social media, or you see them writing here and there, you know, frequently. And I feel like in a way you sort of vanished. And I guess I'm going to start by asking, where the hell did you go?
Well, I just turned out the lights and closed the door, kind of thing. There wasn't much call for it. And I didn't want to scramble too much. So I was okay with that.
Was your last staff job at Sports Illustrated?
Yeah, it was. Yeah. So I was one of those guys. They had one of those ritual buyout things. And I think it was in 2009, and McCallum was itching to do it. And he says, no, you got to do this. It'll be fun. He talked me into it and I did it. Actually, it was a great time to go, but that was it as far as employment, as far as I was concerned. So then I just drifted off into the sunset.
Wait, I'm really interested because there's always this sort of, there's this cliche idea that writers need to write, and the idea of having a byline and having a voice and, you know, maybe to a certain degree needing that attention or needing the feedback or something. Once you took the bio from SI, did you miss it?
Well, it wasn't a cold turkey type of thing. I continued to write for SI for another, 5 or 7 years, maybe longer, off and on. I did have, when I left, I had one book in the pipeline that I was still working on. I guess I thought there would be more. So it was sort of easing into it, but still, you're right. You do, your identity is pretty much wrapped up in it, and it's hard to think of yourself as something else, but it didn't take too long for me to adjust.
I want to start with a story around the year 2000. When I was covering baseball for Sports Illustrated, a friend of a friend connected me with Barry Bonds, and I got him to talk to me. And it was the first time Barry Bonds talked to Sports Illustrated since 1993, when you wrote a piece called The Importance of Being Barry. And I think it's one of the best stories in the history of the magazine. And I just want to real quick, your lead was, the players cluster childlike about their cubicles. They brag or they sulk, depending on whether they've won or lost, whether it's before a game or after. You should see my house, Barry Bonds is saying to Mike Jackson. This occurs in the San Francisco Giants clubhouse before a game. The moon's just so. Major cribbage, Bonds continues. Ceilings 40 feet high. Bring you a videotape. Jackson nods in appreciation. The clubhouse is like any other, an enclave of protracted adolescence where the players needn't mask their pride or even their confusion over fame and fortune. A little later, the same two players confer over pay stubs that they have just been distributed. They are two teens comparing report cards. This invites talk of contracts. What's yours? Bonds asks Jackson, a middle reliever. Two. What's yours? Four, says Bonds. who's somewhat more than twice a ball player Jackson is, but still good-natured about the discrepancy. But soon it'll be eight. They are talking of millions. But Braggs turns to sulk just like that. What is this $30,000 for? Bonds suddenly asks, examining a deduction, and the moons are jolted out of orbit. An interview so incidental to life in the clubhouse that has been now put off 6 days running as a source of comedy among the players is once more deferred. Dude, Bond says, waving the writer away, later, and he vanishes. You obviously are that writer. And after that story, Bonds didn't talk to SI for years. I'm just going to throw a big softball at you. What do you remember about the experience of being assigned to profile Barry Bonds?
Well, being assigned to it, it just was a routine feature. You know, it was pre-Bockel days. You know, there wasn't any controversy or scandal attached to him. And he was just having a great season, I think. And there was no more than that. People don't really understand the guidelines for these assignments are so vague as to be impossible. So I had no marching orders particularly. And so I just went out to see him and thought it would be a run-of-the-mill profile. I think it was scheduled to be a bonus piece, a longer profile than normal. You know, I was up for that. And then, as you mentioned in the lead, it wasn't as clear cut as all that.
So what was the experience like of trying to get Barry Bonds to talk to you?
Well, at first it was aggravating and it was inconvenient, but then I realized that I was onto something here. And, you know, I had a little shtick going on. And as I mentioned in that lead, the players were in on the joke, kind of. Everybody was in on the joke as day after day went on. I mean, I was there so long that other writers from Sports Illustrated were coming to San Francisco or the Bay Area to do some other kind of story, and I was hosting them. It was like, hey, look Hoffer up. You know, I was showing them around town. You know, I was like Herb Kane or something, the resident Bayologist. So at some point, it became a kind of a goof, and you know, I didn't ever do that again, but it was fun once.
You know, there's always this like idea, and I don't agree with it. You know, you're not a part of the story. Don't make yourself a part of the story, etc. And yet that piece, in a lot of ways, there's certainly a focus on this guy keeps blowing you off. Are you angry about it as it's going on?
No, not really. I mean, as I mentioned, at first, you know, it was an inconvenience, but then I realized that this was becoming part of the story. So, you know, I was okay with it. And the idea that I gave Bonds the back of my hand is, well, I guess it's accurate, but it wasn't because of that. I mean, he earned it. Otherwise, it certainly didn't stir any resentment in me that he was doing this. And obviously, I used it more to my advantage than to his.
In the story, there's a lot of detail about what's going on in the clubhouse. And obviously, you're observing these conversations. You observe Robbie Thompson on the phone. You observe Bonds and Mike Jackson, the pitcher, talking about contracts. From your career as a reporter, do you feel like everything you observe is fair game?
Well, I would certainly use my judgment. I mean, I don't think I exploited them in any way. I don't think I used anything that was harmful to them or, you know, would invade their privacy. But, you know, if it was a matter of setting the scene or explaining some character, that was absolutely fair. A clubhouse is a public space. That's open game. And these guys are not children, you know, they kind of were, but if a reporter's in the clubhouse, I think they understand anything goes.
Were you surprised by the backlash?
I don't know that it got that much backlash, or I didn't feel it anyway. I know that Bonds was upset because he hadn't read it, but his cleaning lady read it to him. And I think at that time, the San Francisco press was kind of still in love with him and protective of him. So I might have got some blowback from them, but otherwise, anybody that really knew him, I don't think they could object to the characterization of him.
You attended Miami of Ohio. And it's funny because when you read the Richard Hoffer bio, the limited Richard Hoffer bio that's available on the internet, it says Richard Hoffer wrote for the LA Times. He wrote for Sports Illustrated, obviously, wrote several books. But here I am looking back on March 5th, 1976, the first Richard Hoffer byline I can find. Cincinnati Post headline, UC Ice Cats are 25-2-1. Really? Byline, Richard Hoffer. The lead is Joe Zielinski is building a hockey power at the University of Cincinnati. You may not have noticed. No one else has. I don't know what it's going to take to wake people up, Zielinski lamented. I mean, we can't very well win more games than we have. Undefeated in the last 23 games, the Ice Cats have forged a 25-2-1 record. They close out the season tonight, 6:30 p.m., in a third meeting with rival Miami University at the Golden Skates Rink. As Zielinski is quick to point out, some of these victories have come at the expense of genuine varsity hockey teams. I had no idea you wrote for the Cincinnati Post. There's so much about, of all the guests I've had over the years, especially SI guests, you definitely are the greatest mystery in my sort of interview catalog. Why and how did you even become a journalist?
Well, it was sort of accidental. I was doing construction work in Ohio at the time, and winter rolled around, and I don't know why that surprised me. I had lived there all my life, but suddenly I was unemployed, and my sister-in-law worked at a small newspaper in northeastern Ohio, and she said there was an opening in the sports department up there. Would I be interested? And I said, well, is it indoors? And she said, mostly. And so I went up and applied for the job. I got it. And I had no particular interest in sports, but that's where the opening was. And I would have to say I fell in love with newspaper writing at that time. That was, even at that level, that was pretty exciting. And then I got serious about it and moved around and end up.
So you're this kid in Miami of Ohio. You graduate, then you're working construction. Then you're just told there's this job. Like, did you have clips? Did you have articles from the Miami of Ohio student newspaper, anything of that?
No, of course not. I would never have written for free. I had no background. I mean, I was an English major and, you know, so on. And but no, I don't think I had any particular inclination toward journalism or even thoughts about it at that time. As I say, it was serendipitous, accidental, it was goofy, whatever.
Wait, this actually kind of blows my mind because we live in this era, as you surely know, where journalism jobs have dried up, where a million people apply for one opening at any place. You're this kid working construction, Miami of Ohio grad. Someone says to you, basically, there's an opening at the Cincinnati Post. You don't really care about sports that much, but it's in the sports department. They hire you and you start writing sports.
Well, it wasn't at the Cincinnati Post. It was at the Massillon Evening Independent.
What year was this, Rich?
Well, I had to have been around 72 or something like that.
Okay.
And I interviewed for the job and got it, apparently. But an hour later, I get a call from the editor. It was like, hey, you can type, right? So it was, the qualifications were quite high, you might say. But anyway, it worked out and I had a lot of fun there.
I know you're a quiet guy and definitely sort of humble about this all. It's like, I have a clip in front of me from the Cincinnati Post, March 11th, 1976. Mickey Heeg has edge in aged bowling rivalry with a byline by you. I'm sure you don't even remember this story. And if you do, that's kind of amazing. But your lead is the last ball Mickey Heeg remembered did feel kind of heavy. Weighted with betrayal, the ball represented the 20-year-old's last chance to score better than 7-10. It would strike me as very rare that a guy who had no journalism background, who was doing construction, gets a job at a small paper, then shortly thereafter winds up at the Post, has the natural ability to just write, weighted with betrayal, the ball represented the last chance to score. How did you become this guy who could write?
I don't know. I mean, I guess I had some facility for it, but I remember thinking, even at that first job at that little newspaper in Massillon, I mean, circulation 20,000, a lot of times you would do things besides sports. You would do some court reporting and I would cruise through the courts and, you know, look at the dockets and pick up some item. And you know, I'd have a 3-paragraph thing on the front page because it was kind of bright and funny. And I thought, this is easy. All you have to do is try. And nobody really tried it, it seemed to me. And if you just put some effort in this, you could produce some entertaining stuff. And I didn't understand why nobody else was doing that. But I don't want to say it was easy to me because it wasn't. It required effort. But, you know, I was interested in doing it a little better than the next guy, I suppose.
Did the reporting part of it come fairly naturally to you, the going out? And not just watching Mickey Heeg bowl, but having to talk to Mickey Heeg after he bowled and asking the right questions?
No, that was is and always will be a giant obstacle for me. If I didn't have to talk to people, we'd be great. I'm a horrible interview. Wouldn't say I'm a horrible interview. I could get the job done, but it was just very difficult for me to do. And I think I kind of glided over that weakness with other parts of the job, you know, doing it better, working harder at it. But yeah, the reporting was, I could do it. I mean, anybody smart enough knows what to ask and who to ask. It's just hard.
How do you overcome sort of any level of nervousness or apprehension or whatever it is you have in you to talk to someone and get information?
Well, it's just not comfortable. I mean, it's not fear or nervousness. It's just maybe talking to people. I don't know, something as simple as that, but you have to do it and you do it. I'm not the kind of guy like, you know, that Gary Smith would spend 5 days with, you know, I could never do that. I remember once interviewing Bo Jackson. He was a reluctant interviewee and I was a reluctant interviewer. And he finally eased into the interview and I was getting good stuff after he was refusing to talk and things were flowing. And then you sort of have a line counter in your head. And I thought, now I'm at 400 lines right now. And I said, well, that's about it, Bo. He says, wait, there's more. He says, no, I got to go.
You ended the interview with Bo Jackson.
Yeah. He says, we're good.
I think in 1979, you left Ohio for the LA Times. How'd you get that job and why'd you take it?
Well, it wasn't as straightforward as that. I was working at the Cincinnati Post and I think I was about to get fired. I know that they had put me on the 9 to 5 desk shift. And by that, I mean 9 p.m. to 5 a.m. And I don't know what went wrong there exactly. But anyway, so I left there and I went to the Riverside paper. I interviewed at every paper in California, I think, all the O papers, Fresno, Modesto, Sacramento. And Riverside was the only one that hired me. I remember my wife, while I was doing the interview, I think it must have been 115. And she said, what if we had to live here? I said, don't worry about it. It won't come to that. And then we did. But in a little bit, I did get the LA Times. I think they had some kind of a hiring spree and they hired a lot of young guys. By then, I did have, as you mentioned before, some clips to show for myself. And so I eased into there.
I feel like when I think of you as a writer, I think of you as a boxing writer. I have a piece in front of me, just as an example. The next title would put Aguayo in a class by himself. Richard Hoffer, Los Angeles Times, 1982. The way it's worked in the past, Alexis Aguayo would suddenly materialize at your civic arena, visit some violence on your hometown hero, and then just as suddenly vanish. Before you could restore consciousness to your civic pride, Aguayo would be on his way to some other country, some other civic arena, some other civic pride. That's the way it had to work. Aguayo had no country of his own, no constituency, no cause. His only real citizenship was his craft, boxing. What is it about boxing, or how did you become a quote-unquote boxing guy?
Well, I didn't set out to become that. I mean, that was, as was most things in my life, that was where the opening was. But I did like fighters. I loved fighters. They were so transparent, so earnest, so authentic, so genuine, compared to, say, Barry Bonds,
yeah.
That you just had to love them. Even the very best and most arrogant of them and most successful boxers were easy stories. I mean, I just loved hanging with them. I didn't love the fights so much. I kind of was ambivalent about what was going on in the ring. I could recognize from time to time that glorious things were being done. I mean, people were just the extension of their will in the ring was occasionally amazing to see, but it was came at some cost. And like I say, I was not entirely comfortable with the sport, but I did love the fighters.
Who is your favorite fighter to just sit down with and talk to through the years?
Well, George Foreman, that's a no-brainer. I mean, he's kind of crazy, he's funny, and he's a great talker. He's just one of those great talkers. You could just sit down and a stenographer could make a story with George Foreman. You know, I don't want to overlook Ali. I kind of hooked onto him at the end of his days, but still, the entertainment value there was quite high. But yeah, Foreman was, he was gold every time.
Is it weird to cover a sport where guys are bashing each other's heads in and you sort of see their declines at such a rapid pace, and yet you love talking to them, and it's at the same time kind of hurtful?
Well, like I said, I was always very uncomfortable with the sport itself and what it did to people. And as time went on, I could see that. I covered, I think, 3 ring deaths and a lot more deaths in the making in terms of physical decline. So there was an awfulness to it. And you had to reconcile that if you could. I don't know that I could. And whenever it came time to not do boxing, I was okay with that too, because I just didn't like seeing it at some point.
What were the 3 ring deaths you covered?
Let's see, there was Johnny Owen, there was Duck Koo Kim. I think there was a third. I don't want to seem that they were so casual that I can't remember them, but it was not cool.
Actually, I will say November 16th, 1982, LA Times. After the coming out cry, there's little to be done. This is your byline. Another boxer lies dying, his brain, quote unquote, terminally injured. We now await his death and, of course, the outcry. It may be more compelling this time. Surely it is boxing itself that is to blame for what doctors say is a certain death of Korea's Duck Koo Kim. It was not the matchmaker's fault. Kim had credentials enough for a title fight. It was not the commission doctor's fault. Kim had enough health. And it wasn't the referee's fault. The blow that ruptured a blood vessel in Kim's brain was, according to doctors and ringsiders, a single one. The fight in Las Vegas Saturday, which ended in the 14th round when Kim crumpled helpless to the canvas, could not reasonably have been stopped sooner. Kim's trauma, in other words, could not have been foreseen. The usual precautions had been taken, and they were insufficient. As promoter Bob Arum said, nothing went wrong. That's a sad commentary on this all. In the past, there was always an excuse. So I've never covered a death. I've never witnessed a death in sport. What is it like? And I guess I remember that vividly. What was it like covering sort of Mancini, Duck Koo Kim, and the aftermath of it?
Well, it was sort of a slow, agonizing process. It's not like you saw a guy shot dead in the ring right in front of you. You know, there was always, I don't know, maybe there was hope at some point that this guy would survive. In all these cases, they were more or less lingering deaths. So you kind of had a chance to wrap your mind around the event, I guess, as it unfolded. But still, there, you could see there was an inevitability about it, and this wasn't going to end well. It was horrible.
It's interesting that we were talking about this. One of the stories I printed out that you wrote was from the LA Times in 1985. And it was, Mancini has fame and fortune. Why fight it? And you wrote, Ray Mancini, the kid who gave the lightweight division a lot of its marquee value, probably left boxing when he left the ring last week. He's made $6 million, achieved his championship dream, and laid a groundwork of fame that should keep him in good stead, if not more income, for years to come. Besides, he could fight Livingston Bramble, a decidedly limited fighter, 100 times and not beat him. At just 24, Mancini is perceptibly slowed. More telling, Mancini has shown a horrifying tendency to bleed. It's enough to know a fighter has guts. We don't have to actually see them. So goodbye, Ray. Been nice having you. Get out and enjoy your money, your fame. Maybe meet a nice girl. See you around. This is going to sound like a weird question. I don't even know how to phrase it. How are you able to mix commentary, observation, reporting, etc., without sounding overly judgmental?
I'm not sure how to answer that. I mean, I always have confidence in myself and confidence in my material. And I always think that I have a good enough handle on the thing that I can speak with some authority. You know, if I don't know what I'm talking about, I'm not going to pipe up and offer any solutions to anybody. But, you know, sometimes you know what you're doing. And I'm not afraid to, you know, step out of that little reporter's confines and issue some commentary. I don't do it often. I never did it often. But when I was comfortable doing it, I think I got away with it.
All right, there's a line here. It's enough to know a fighter has guts. Semicolon, we don't have to actually see them. How does that kind of thing even enter your head to write?
As I said before, when I was surprised that people didn't take more effort in their writing, you know, just think, you know, sometimes, and something will come to you. I guess part of it is not being satisfied with something ordinary, and you just try better.
Were you at all conflicted about the jump to Sports Illustrated, or is that an easy call when the magazine reached out to you?
Oh, no, that was pretty easy. I'd been at the LA Times for 12 years, and even at that point, that was too long to be there. Was, you know, what are you going to be, one of those guys? Here's Richard Hoffer. He's at his 50th Rose Bowl. There's a redundancy to sports anyway. I mean, the seasons roll around, and there's only so much you could do. I wasn't going to be Jim Murray there. I don't know what I ever could have been, but probably was as good as it was going to get there. So that was no problem leaving the LA Times and Sports Illustrated. I mean, of course, who wouldn't go there? That was, you know, a dream job if you dared to dream it. So yeah, that was an easy call.
So what was the adjustment going from a newspaper writer to a magazine writer?
You know what, as far as writing, not much. I mean, I had more space, more time. You know, I kind of quickly adjusted to that. And we never, you know, as a newspaper writer, you don't write 6,000 word stories generally. So that wasn't a problem for me for some reason. I kind of adjusted to the length. I easily adjusted to having weeks to do a story. That was great. And all those resources. The one thing is, it's sort of lonely. You know, I was out on the West Coast at that time. Everyone in New York, you know, that's pretty far away. You don't see anybody. You don't talk to anybody. You know, you don't know where you stand ever. It's sort of, wasn't frightening, but it was just odd. And I'm actually better off the less I talk to editors or have anything to do with them. And so I think that's permitted me to work there that long. But it is, you know, you don't get much feedback, and it's a little uncomfortable at times, but that was really the only adjustment for me.
A lot of the writers I've had on who jump from a newspaper to being a writer at SI talk about the adjustment to being edited by 17 people before piece ran. Was that not a problem for you at all?
You know, it wasn't. You know, I hear these stories too, and I think I must have had a pretty light hand on me compared to others. And certainly the longer I was there, then the more confidence they have in you. I mean, of course the editing is aggravating. I mean, I remember Lee Montville, a colleague of ours, saying at one time, I can make three people laugh. I can't make four people laugh, because that fourth level of editing, you know, is where they get you. And so it was unnerving if there was some executive editor way down the line who happened to have an interest in toy trains or something, says, well, what does this guy think about toy trains? You know, and then you had to respond to that. So it was some built-in idiocy there. But again, I think I enjoyed a pretty light hand in that regard. And I mean, the process of getting published there is exhausting, but it wasn't that bad for me.
Did you get a buzz off of, I don't know, a cover story or, if you know, a 12-page piece? Would that do it for you? Or once you wrote the story, were you done with the story?
Kind of once you write it, because that's the last time you own that story. So, you know, anything can happen to it after you turn it in. But what, you know, the buzz, as you call it, is having written. You know, it's fun to see it on the cover, but, you know, that's kind of a irrelevant thing. You don't get a cover story because it was a good story. It's because some circumstance or something. So I never kept score that way.
You did a really great piece in 1992, Destined to Fall, about Mike Tyson. And your lead was, Mike Tyson's career was the equivalent of a held breath. A sense of urgency attended every aspect of it. Twice a month bouts after he exploded onto the boxing scene in 1985, a hastily won heavyweight championship by the age of 20, a quick consolidation of the crown at 21. It was a flurry of ferocity never before seen. So rushed was the entire concussive enterprise that when his manager, Jimmy Jacobs, put together a video of Tyson's knockouts as a promotional tool, the resulting montage of helpless fighters slipping along the ropes and onto the canvas, one right after another, seemed to play out in real time. When you were writing about boxing and you were writing about Tyson, and it was all Tyson all the time, Tyson, 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 were you thinking, we're witnessing the next Ali, Frazier, whoever, Jack Johnson, Rocky Marciano? Or are you thinking there's a lot of hype and kind of ridiculousness to this saga?
Well, I didn't think I was witnessing Jack Johnson or even Ali, that's for sure. I mean, he was a phenomenon. And, you know, we look at him now and kind of a little bit as a joke, but he was not nothing. But on the other hand, he wasn't the second coming either. I think most people saw that he was pretty carefully managed, pretty carefully promoted, you know, and he was fierce and he was accomplished. But yeah, he was a man of his time and not much more, I think.
What was he like to cover?
Well, it was weird. I mean, I was there a couple of times and he did have a temper and things could get explosive. I think at one point he said he was going to make me cry like a woman. I don't know how hard that would have been anyway, but on the other hand, if you just were there to observe him and witness him and you see these childlike tendencies, and it was sort of, you know, it was pretty absorbing to watch him. He was an intricate machine, that's for sure. I don't think he was that difficult to explain, but he was fun to watch. I enjoyed that opportunity. Again, he's like one of those fighters that's, you know, just keeps on giving as far as a writer is concerned.
Before we continue with Two Riders Slinging Yang, a quick word from our sponsor.
Hey, this is KSU Perlman, and I'm here with Anna Norris, my co-host on the hit KSCTU radio show,
We're So Crazy.
So, with the Screen Actors on strike, I landed us this pretty sweet gig doing an ad for my dad's podcast.
What the fuck's a podcast?
This thing old people watch.
Well, what's the ad for?
RoyalRetros.com. It's a throwback sports merchandise company that makes pretty sweet t-shirts, hats, and jerseys of old sports leagues.
Do we get paid?
In t-shirts. But he also says, if we do a good job, we might advance to hats and jerseys.
And then what?
And then you wear a hat.
Hard pass. I'm going back to my side hustle slinging rocks on the streets of La Jolla.
Do you, when you're covering these guys, especially boxers, and you know, the majority of these guys come from pretty low income areas, they're almost always being taken advantage of by some Don King type figure. When it's all going on and you're covering them, do you have a sense of empathy because you know what's coming for them, or do you not even think of it?
Well, in a way, I was lucky because I was only covering the most successful of them. Oscar De La Hoya was going to end up on his feet. I mean, I thought that Tyson might end up on his feet. I didn't. So these guys are making enough money and they're so successful that it would be hard to screw it up. So those aren't the guys that are really getting crippled by the sport so much, although we've got some sad stories, of course, to tell. So it wasn't doom foretold necessarily, but you might, in the back of your head, tell them to be careful.
Every now and then I'll watch the Boxing Hall of Fame induction ceremonies. And if you go on YouTube, they'll have videos of like just the boxers showing up. And it's like, hey, there's Mitch Blood Green. And, you know, hey, there's Shane Mosley. And just so many times they show up and their speech is horribly slurred and they're limping and they look 20 years older than they are and they're wearing all their chains and their sunglasses, but it's all really sad. And it's just, I loved writing about boxing, but it just kind of breaks my heart to see what happens to boxers.
It's a tough game.
In 2009, you wrote a book, Jackpot Nation, Rambling and Gambling Across Our Landscape of Luck. And it's really all about gambling in America and what you can gamble on and the ridiculousness of gambling. And in a lot of ways, I feel like this book came out 15 years too early because we live now in this nation where gambling is so widely accepted, consuming, disturbing, in many ways disgusting. What inspired you to write Jackpot Nation?
Well, being a boxing writer, you end up in Vegas over and over and over again. I was going there like every other month. And from the beginning, I started playing table games at a low level. And, you know, your threshold for risk ramps up inevitably. So I was probably spending as much time playing blackjack as I was covering boxing while I was out there. You know, I kind of became familiar with the milieu and what was going on. And it just seemed like a no-brainer to try to do something like that.
How do you view sort of gambling in sports in America? You know, teams in Vegas now, the A's possibly moving to Vegas, lines offered on every game. Are you kosher with that, or do you see it as problematic?
You know, I'm okay with it in the sense that it's always been there. I mean, there's some new wrinkles, you know, in play betting or whatever, but you know, basically that's, it's nothing new. We've had gambling from the get-go, and you know, that's what actually sustains some of these sports, is the amped up interest you get from having $5 on the outcome. So I don't even think about it. I mean, it's just, it's there, it's been there, and it's going to be there.
Do you enjoy writing books?
Yeah, I did. That was a lot of fun. I mean, it's, I don't know what your experience is like, but you know, you're by yourself, you're doing whatever you want to do. There's nobody telling you, you know, what to do. You can explore your own interest and explore it in ways that other people might not approve. So the trick is getting people to read those things and buy them, which I didn't master, but I certainly love the process of doing it.
I was talking the other day to a friend of mine, Mark Kriegel, who's a really excellent boxing writer and has been doing it for a long time. And I told him that I was having you on this podcast. He said two things. He said, Richard Hoffer, he said he's one of the best boxing writers ever. He is delightfully disinterested in any sort of self-promotion. And then he said, you have to read the piece he wrote a bunch of years ago for The National. Mayweather versus Pacquiao shows that boxing writing is on the ropes. And you wrote this piece May 13th, 2015. I loved every word of it. I'm just going to read a little real quick. You wrote, like a lot of you who are either too cheap to spring for pay-per-view or, more reasonably, had seen Floyd Mayweather fight before and guessed exactly what disappointment was about to unfold, I consumed the action for free, 140 characters at a time, the 21st century version of peeping through a stadium knothole. Best round for Manny, lands solid right hands, so tweeted one of my trusted correspondents. Floyd on cruise control, winning handily. Sadly, it was all I needed to know, or yet more sadly, the best I could have expected to read. The coverage of Mayweather's fight with Pacquiao, like every other sporting event these days, was nearly atomized by today's need for immediacy. Even the next day's journalism, which ought to have offered a fuller explanation of such momentous events, it was a fight of the century, right? It was a little more developed than an internet listicle. Here's the money Floyd made. Here are the ligaments Manny tore. Here's a boredom we all suffered. Sport in general, but boxing in particular, is now apparently bereft of metaphor. I just want to read one more thing. And what a shame that is. Boxing by tradition, going back to Homer anyway, has always been a reliable wellspring of literature, a place where prose dance on the page as surely as the boxers on canvas. No other sport has ever come close. Whether it's novels, whether it's drama, whether it's the next day's newspaper column, boxing has been the source of so much good writing, it rightfully deserves its own genre. And it's this, I mean, awesome times a thousand piece about really the death of boxing writing. What do you think happened and what has gone wrong?
Well, number one, boxing is not the sport it once was back in the day. You know, the heavyweight champion was the most famous man in this country. And so it was, you know, there was a shared interest in these people. Now, I mean, even while I was covering it, the heavyweight champion wasn't even necessarily from this country and wasn't necessarily interesting. And coupled with the dearth of newspaper writing and magazine writing, you know, boxing became a kind of a niche minor sport. And so it just didn't attract the talented people. I mean, you had back in the day, Norman Mailer would pop in and cover a fight for you, or it's mind-boggling to think of the interest that sport attracted among these great writers. And even in newspapers, I mean, the best writers were covering boxing, not necessarily on the grassroots level, but, you know, you had your columnists come out there and weigh in on it. And then eventually columnists stopped going to the fights. So it just was a kind of natural diminishment of the coverage, I guess.
On the one hand, I look at boxing and I think that was the most fun sport to cover. On the other hand, I look at boxing and think, argument can definitely be made that this sport should probably not exist. Where do you fall on the spectrum?
Well, as I mentioned before, I was always ambivalent about it. And I think among my peers, I think they kind of resented me for that because I showed that ambivalence and I didn't necessarily think that this was a worthwhile sport anymore. It was just doing a lot of damage. And I think a lot of my fellow writers kind of resented that and thought I was, they didn't agree. But I never thought that this was a a great way for these kids to make a living. Or, and I never felt comfortable watching these guys bleed in the ring. So, you know, I just was as soon out of it as in.
Are you far enough removed that the sort of death of Sports Illustrated, all the layoffs at the LA Times, the decline of journalism as a whole, I don't know, you don't pay that much attention to, or are you sort of troubled by the way everything is going?
Well, I mean, it was such an inevitability that it's hard to, you know, each new disappointment doesn't really trigger anything for me anymore. I mean, I've seen this happening for the last, I don't know, 20 years even maybe. It's just, it's like going broke slowly and then suddenly it's just, you know, disappearing. So it's hard to register any shock or anything at this point. Of course, I'm disappointed. I mean, these institutions that were so fun and so valuable are just gone, and they're not going to be replaced. You know, I just don't see the fun coming back anymore. Whether you're a reader, whether you're a writer, that part of our life is gone.
If you're some kid in Ohio now and you're working construction and someone says there's a job at the local newspaper, do you say, nah, I think I'm just going to stick with construction. Media is dying.
Well, first of all, there probably isn't a local newspaper anymore.
Yeah.
But I would encourage you to go into real estate or some other important industry.
Do you view yourself as a retired writer?
No, I think that impulse has passed. I think, you know, maybe certainly within the last couple of years, I've found other things to do. And it's just, you know, there's not much call for this. There's not much interest in these things. I mean, even if someone said, yeah, you know, your book proposal sounds interesting, you know, let's move ahead, I would have to think, you know, that's going to take a lot of work. And, you know, the outcome is iffy at best. So I'll let it go. I just, you know, at some point you miss it and then you don't really need it anymore. And I'm definitely retired.
Well, Richard, as I said at the opening, you're one of my all-time favorite writers. And I know you don't do many of these. And I really, I appreciate you taking the time to talk with me.
Been a lot of fun. Thank you.
I want to thank today's guest, Richard Hoffer, for joining me on Two Writers Sing and Yang. You can follow Richard absolutely, positively nowhere. But Google his name to read some great stuff. If you have a chance and enjoy Two Writers Sing and Yang, please, please, please go to the vehicle of your choice and leave a nice review. I'd be really appreciative. Music is by the explosive MC White Owl. Thanks again for joining me. And remember, keep writing.